Hello there and welcome to another episode of Marketing Room 101, the podcast where I invite marketers for a good old rant and give them the chance to banish one thing from the industry forever. I'm Ben Norman, your host and self-appointed guardian of Marketing Room 101. In my day job, I head up strategy at Principles, a brand comms agency in Leeds, and I started this podcast because I both deeply love and occasionally loathe the marketing world, so I wanted to provide a safe space for those who feel the same to vent and banish their nemeses forever. In this episode, I had the pleasure of chatting to Gareth Healy, who was the CEO and co-founder of the first agency I ever worked at, which under his leadership grew from fewer than 30 people to over 175, won tons of awards for both their work and their investment in people and culture, and also became Campaign's top UK regional agency. Since exiting that business a few years ago, he has dedicated his time to helping others to manage and grow their agencies, something he's literally written the book on. Principles, where I work, is one of the many agencies that Gareth supports and mentors in his role as a consultant with Cactus. And I can say firsthand from working with him over the years that Gareth has this refreshing skill for taking a step back and seeing the bigger picture. In my experience, he'll listen intently to so many different voices before giving really considered advice in a very calm, collected way. And I've been exposed to very few businesses that couldn't do with more of that. So here's my conversation with Gareth Healy. Gareth, welcome to Marketing Room 101.
Thank you very much, Ben.
My pleasure. Before we get stuck in, I just wondered if you could describe the room for our listeners. What is it sort of like down here in Marketing Room 101?
Well, I'm quite shocked, actually, because I do have to describe it because we've had to suppress the sound because the thing that's shocked me the most is the noise. It's very, very noisy down here under normal circumstances. It's quite dark, but it's absolutely the cacophony of noise making it very, very difficult to concentrate, very difficult to focus. Just seems like there's lots going on. It reminds me, actually, those films where there's a torture scene and people are locked in a room with constant loud rock music to keep them awake. It's that sort of thing. That's the vibe.
Rather than loud rock music, what did you find was filling the air before we soundproofed it?
Yeah. Just people shouting for me at all directions. Come over here, buy this, buy that. Don't buy that from them, buy this from us. It's just an absolute, yeah, it's like the markets. I mean, yeah. The old markets. That's a nice experience, but where the traders were shouting, it's like that, but amplified by 1,000.
So is that what marketing's become now? Just this big old shouting match?
I think it is, hasn't it? But the key is we've got to cut through, haven't we? I mean, not just brands, actually, individuals, whatever we're doing. The noise is there, but it's got to find some way of cutting through.
When we first met, you were the CEO of the first agency I ever worked for. I was an account executive in my first ever job. It sort of feels a bit funny to acknowledge because if I recall rightly, I was a bit afraid to talk to you and your co-founder. You were the big bosses. I was the spotty-faced kid coming in for my first day. But you actually grew that business from about 30 people in the late 90s when you took over with your co-owner to growing the business to almost 200 people before you left in, was it 2015, 2016?
2017, actually.
2017,
yeah.
Over that 18 or so years, you'd become a retail powerhouse, a creative powerhouse in the north. You worked with clients like Asda, Greggs, Coral, Ladbrokes, Halfords. They're the ones that I remember from when I worked there. I'm sure there were plenty more over the time. I guess rather than telling me the story of how you grew that business, what I'm really interested in, or what I'd like to ask you is how did you feel on that first morning when you woke up and you were no longer the CEO of that business that had been such an important part of your life for almost 20 years?
Well, that is a really interesting question. That's not often something that I'm asked, but an important one. I mean, I guess, thinking back, what was it like? It was a big relief, actually. In so much as I exited my business partner bought me out. And that was a very amicable. We managed that situation between us, I think, very, very well because we hadn't fallen out. So it wasn't a big drama, but that partnership had sort of reached a point, where we needed to do something different, each of us. So he bought me out. So it was a relief. But in terms of that, it was a difficult situation. It was amicable and we managed it well, but it was still a difficult thing to do and an unusual thing to do to sell, your shares in a business. So relief that the deal had been done, I guess. Relief that both of us were not comfortable and not happy in what we were doing at that time. I said, so relief that that was now over and a new chapter could begin. So, overall relief, but not in a sort of huge sense of, thank God that I've moved on from that, but just thank God, the sort of situation has been resolved and we can move on.
If we fast forward to now, so that was 2017. Now, I worked with you when you were there equally, and I work with you because you consult with Principles.
helping us guide our growth and guide the agency as you do with many other agencies. You've written a book, Stand Out or Die, and that's how to grow your agencies is the message in there. So you do a lot of work helping agencies grow now. Was that a plan? Or, you know, from that point where you left and you did wake up that morning, did you have an idea of where you wanted to go? Did you have anything sort of on your agenda that you wanted to do? Or did that just come after you'd got a bit bored?
Yeah. Was it a plan? No, it wasn't a plan. When I left my agency after, not just because I exited the business, but because I'd worked in agencies by that time for many, many years, I thought that was it for me. I thought I would go on to do something else. I also thought at that time, maybe that first morning as now non-CEO, I would be waking up and looking out from my yacht in Monaco, which I wasn't, just for the record. I was comfortable and in a reasonable position, but didn't achieve that, but nevertheless achieved a lot. But did I expect to be still working in agencies now, or working in the agency sector to some degree now, which is 7 years later? Absolutely not. Thought I'd be doing something else. It was only after sort of 6 months post, you know, my exit that I started to think and realise that, you know, I had a lot of agency experience, still had a lot of passion and for the industry. I had done my time working directly with client brands, which I'd spent a lot of my career doing, but I was an account manager by trade, but that's how I started out. So I still had a passion and an interest in having clients and a desire to work with clients and help support service clients. But it was only after a few months that I realised, actually, maybe I could turn my talents in a slightly different way in the industry to being somebody that works with agencies as a non-exec and an advisor, not running agencies, but helping agencies grow, run better businesses. That's what I do now. And get a massive amount of satisfaction from it. Didn't expect to write a book. It was a bit of a bucket list thing, actually, having said that, but I never thought I'd get around to it. COVID was the catalyst. It took me far longer than the lockdowns, I'd say, but nevertheless, that was the catalyst.
So from your book, from Stand Out or Die, there are a number of principles in there, and, you know, I'd encourage people to read it. But if there's one takeout that an agency owner can start doing right now, what's the first thing that they should do to set them on that track to becoming stand out rather than stand still?
My book, Stand Out or Die, there's 55,000 words in that book, a bit of structure to it, lots of different areas covered. But I always say you can summarise it in one word, actually, and the word is focus. So the theme across many different areas is focus. You know, we used to work with Asda. You remember, Ben, you did as well.
Yeah.
Great business. And Alan Layton, the ex-CEO of Asda, had this phrase, winners focus, losers spray, which is always something that stuck with me.
Hopefully people will be listening to this that are both working agency side and client side. How could a client in a marketing team assess whether they are working with a standout or a standstill agency? What do you think could be the telltale signs?
I think that from a client's perspective, if anybody is kind enough to read my book, they'll find out the standout agency model is multifaceted. But from a client perspective, I always say that the standout agency is one that is proactive, that is communicative, does the work and delivers the work, of course, but is the one that comes to them with ideas, new approaches, new ways of doing things, stimulus to say, this is how we can improve your business. Proactivity and gives the key from a client perspective.
I think from my experience, are you curious? Are you asking questions? Or are you just taking orders? And also, are they listening to the business problem? Are they listening to the bigger picture?
That's a great point, yeah. It's the David Ogilvy thing, isn't it? To really engage with your clients, you need to be interested in their business, not just because you're being asked to do something, because you're generally interested in helping them. So, yeah, great point.
If you're a marketer and you're free on the 5th of February, get yourself to Leeds for Every Second Counts, But Which Counts the Most? The event that Principles Agency, along with Boutique Media, are putting on to give you the chance to hear from leading marketers and channel experts as they unpick the confusing shitstorm of modern media and help you understand the true value of every second of attention paid to any channel so you can make better decisions in 2025. To find out more and get a free ticket code if you're a brand, drop me, Ben Norman, or Principles Agency a message on LinkedIn.
So you're here today because you want to banish something from the marketing industry forever. Can I ask you, please, what you would like to banish?
Well, I'd like to banish the agency pitch process.
Okay, you have my ear.
Probably an obvious one to many people, but the practice of agencies pitching to clients for work in a competitive environment. But I am a realist, if nothing else, and I realise that perhaps that's unlikely to happen.
Mm.
So I'm going to just, if I may, Ben, I'm just going to pivot it slightly into not all pitch processes, but the, you know, what I call lottery pitching, the pitches that are unstructured, unfair, unpaid, the sort of pitch and pray situation that agencies often find themselves in, where they're pitching into the dark and have no idea what the criteria is for winning it, who they're up against, how many people are up against, don't get paid for it, don't know how much work to do and how little work to do, etc., etc. So pitches in general, I'd love to get rid of it. I understand why the pitch process exists. It exists because it's now ingrained and the agencies, there's no cartels, so that we're not going to break it, sadly. But fundamentally, it exists because we are, all agencies are selling intangible services, aren't we? No matter what we say, the work that we do is certainly in the first engagement is an intangible thing. You can't physically see what's going to happen. There's a trust issue there. If a client is wanting to work or does work with agencies, appointing a new one is a big deal. You know, there's a lot of money involved. Yeah. Nobody in any client business, of course, can afford to be spending money these days. And then their CFOs are very much on their case in terms of what they're spending, when, why, who they're spending it with. So they don't want to get that decision wrong. So I understand that pitch process, beauty parade, why it exists. So we can't probably get rid of it all. And also, from an agency perspective, I work for a business called Cactus, and we've just done a growth survey with 250 agencies. Where do you get your new business from? And the second major source of new business wins for those 250 clients, unsurprisingly, was pitching. So it's a source of new business. So I'd upset clients and agencies if I got rid of it completely. But coming back to about that sort of lottery pitching, pitch and pray, bad pitches.
Yeah.
That's got to go.
It's something where I enjoy this as a topic because I don't know exactly where I stand on it, because I think you're kind of covering it off here where you say pitch and pray, because I love pitching. Mm. I love the challenge. I feel like there's nothing more exciting than going into a pitch. There's nothing more exciting than the buzz you get around the business when there is a pitch on the table, when everybody is firing on all cylinders. You get that when there is a really big, exciting pitch. But that happens when there is a clear pitch process.
Yeah.
As opposed to what you're saying here, which is pitch and pray, which is so intangible. If you're up against 20 businesses rather than if you're up against three, how do you then decide? Because you don't know how many you're against.
Yeah.
You can't decide what resource you're putting into that pitch. You can't decide whether that client has been through. Do they know what they want? Do I know that client knows what they want? Do I even know that anybody will be appointed at the end of it? I guess what's interesting here is the thing that's overlooked is the actual cost to agencies. You run an agency for long enough. What do you think the real cost is to agencies?
Well, I think pitching, I've been pitching all my life. Yeah. Salesmanship should be more part of education, really, in my opinion. But so pitching is not always a bad thing. The buzz that you get in the meetings and pitches, creating the work, can be some of the best times in agencies. And when you win, as you just mentioned, your principals, I think we've just won a couple, there's a palpable vibe in the business, isn't there? A positivity. Yeah, and so, you know, it's a really good thing. So there's many benefits to it, but yeah, the cost. The IPA estimates that agencies can spend up to 30% of the resources on pitching, often and usually unpaid. So there's a financial cost, and some of the bigger agencies can not afford, but can stomach some of those big costs. But when you're running a small business, potentially a third of your resources devoted to doing work that may not result in anything is not a viable business model, is it? So there's a financial cost, but I think there's also a mental cost as well, because, you know, all agencies lose pitches here and there, and many with more competition, and with some of the pitches that go on where there's numerous people involved, there are clearly more losers than there are winners. So there's a mental toll as well, particularly in creative businesses, you know, creative directors and creative people, you know, they often take it very personally, of course, don't they? It's not just the agency, it's their creativity, it's their output. And when it's rejected, there's a mental issue there. So that's life, that's business. And we can't protect that totally, but I think the costs can be significant.
Also, the cost to your existing clients is often the overlooked cost.
True, yeah.
The, you know, what does it mean for your existing clients? A lot of teams are quite lean, and we know that resources are always at a premium. You don't have 30% of your business's resource sat around doing nothing. So to what extent is that having an impact on existing clients?
No, that's a great point. I just think it sort of impacts existing clients, and particularly just to build on it, where the existing clients are those clients that often pitch the work.
Yes.
You know, so, and they will say that's a benefit, that's a good thing, we're keeping you sharp, we're looking at the market. Okay, I understand that, but you could think of the resource that agency could have put into working with you, working with the client, rather than being in a lottery or a competition with other people.
So if we're going to consider putting pitch and pray pictures in. So we're not saying all pictures, but we're saying in particular these pitch and pray pictures. Mm. What would you say is the alternative, or what would you say to a client who is running a pitch process about how to avoid that? What's the alternative, and maybe why do we think this happens in the first place?
Yeah, I think, what's the alternative? Well, there is actually a movement led by the IPA. I think the ISBA are involved as well. The Pitch Positive Pledge, lots of agencies signed up to, and some big clients as well. And that's a step in this direction. For me personally, I don't think it goes far enough. It talks about concepts and people sign up to it, great, but I don't think it goes far enough, because the things I've got, sort of a manifesto of my own, that I guess is call it a pitch perfect manifesto, but it's a manifesto for good pitching, I guess, to avoid the pitch and pray. There's 10 things on it. Shall I whiz through?
100%, please do, yeah.
Yeah. So number one, let's go straight in, feet first, compensation. So unpaid pitching, where there's a lot of work to do and is completely unpaid, is a massive challenge for agencies, particularly small ones. So again, I'm a realist. I'm not suggesting that every pitch should be fully paid by the client, every agency involved, but they have more ability to do that if they don't choose as many agencies to get involved. And maybe agencies aren't compensated for all of their costs on the pitch, but there's some compensation. It covers some of the costs.
So if I can say on that, I've experienced that twice in my career, where out of however many pitches that I've been involved in, and both of those pitches, they didn't make us any money. We didn't make profit on them. Like you say, it's covering costs. It's almost a token gesture, but they were the best, most thought through pitches I've ever worked on. And they clearly restricted the number of people that they invited in to do it.
Yeah, that's throw it on to everybody, because we're paying a few people to do some work for us. So
yeah, I'm not saying that it's appropriate for all businesses to find a lot of money to then put on a pitch process when budgets are tight a lot of the time. But if you can find some form of compensation for a pitch, you will often find, therefore, the brief that you get on the back of that is much more considered. So I think 100%, I'd love to see that more often.
The biggest thing on this sort of thing for me is that lack of respect. You know, even a notional amount shows a degree of respect from the client, doesn't it? So that's number one. Number two is limit the number of agencies. My heart drops every time I talk to an agency and they talk to me about we're in a pitch and there's 10 other agencies, you know.
Yeah.
I talked earlier about the value in a pitch, generating the trust and being able to see and talk to people. And there is some of that, but narrow it down, please.
I don't know if it happens as much these days, but even the chemistry session, the pre-pitch discussion, where you can take that list of 10 agencies, you don't need 10 agencies involved.
No.
Take that list of 10 agencies, have a discussion with them, see if the chemistry is right, see if you can actually work with these people.
Can I work with these?
And then reduce to then, 3-4.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. And that saves everybody time. That's a great build on that. So limit the number of people involved. Obviously, well-defined briefs, detailed briefs, goes without saying, but so many times we see incomplete and not well thought through briefs, you know, that's really important. Transparency in what the decision making criteria is. So what the client is going to look at when they're judging. Chemistry, if you mentioned, is going to be in there, of course. That's again quite intangible, but price, strategic thinking, creativity. You know, the best run pitches, often run by some of the sort of intermediaries, of course, have that laid out, but so many others don't. So transparency in the decision-making progress, respect for, this is a really important one, respect for intellectual property, of course.
Oh, yes.
So where agencies have pitched and nothing hurts agencies more than pitching and then seeing their work or a version of it appear when they've lost. You know, that's so absolutely soul-destroying when that happens. Clarity of budgets and timelines, controversial on this. We ran a conference down in London and we had some CMOs on the panel. And one of the CMOs, one of the clients said she didn't like to do that because she didn't want it to limit agencies.
Mm.
As in, if I tell them it's 100 grand, you know, they'll spend 100 grand. And if they come up with a really good idea, I might spend more than 100 grand. Now, that might be true, but I just don't buy that argument. I'm sorry. I think it's much fairer to at least, even if it's a range, you know, give us a scope, because again, what's the point in pitching if you know that you're going to come up with 50 grand's worth of campaigns and the budget's only 10 grand or a grand? So let's all face it, we've had the nightmares.
If that's transparent up front, that also gives the agency the opportunity to make the decision about whether they go for the pitch in the first place.
Yeah.
Because the last thing you want is an agency to go through the pitch process to then find out that the brief is too small for them to be able to afford to resource and work on. So it's, again, that clarity on both sides, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think that's the point on the, you know, the number of agencies in the pitch. Somebody went, well, why is that important? Or who they are? Why is that important? I think it is important because if I'm in a pitch with other agencies And we're in the north here in Leeds. And let's say we're going to doing a pitch, Ben, for our agency. And there's another five agencies in the pitch. The other five of them, are all London-based. That might not necessarily be a bad thing. That might not necessarily be a sign. But if you know that, you can start to think, is the location an issue here? Our five of the pitch agencies, four-man bands or four-woman bands, and one of them or two of them are publicists and Ogilvies. I'm probably exaggerating to make a point, but you know, if you hang on a minute, there's something wrong here. Somebody's either not clear on what they're looking for, or somebody's misconstrued what we do and what size we are, or whatever. And then number seven is honest feedback when you lose. So stopping this, we come a close second mentality. You know, so many agencies say we're always just miss out on the pitches. We're always come a close second. You know,
it's funny how often you come close second, and it's very rarely you come. Oh, actually, you were fourth.
You were miles off. And it's just bullshit. People don't want to tell you the truth. They just want to get you off the phone or drop you an email and placate you. But I actually, as much as it hurts at the time, I actually think genuinely that most agency owners I know would much rather know that they were completely off the pace, that they were double the costs, that the chemistry didn't work. That's the value if you've lost the pitch, because you can learn, understand, you can change your approach for the next one. And then pitch you for long-term partnerships, not short-term briefs. It's always something, of course, just as well, they want the long-term part. I think let's pitch when it's a long-term relationship, when it's a big campaign, a big investment. But again, frustrates me more when you see these clients pitching for some tiny projects, 10 agencies are pitching. No.
The response you get, if you're clear at the start and say, actually, this is a 24-month contract, yeah, and we want a strategic partner to work with us, that's going to attract the best people from the best agencies to put their best effort into a pitch. Yeah. So I 100% agree there.
And final two, again, obvious ones, no speculative work. Ideally, the Pitch Perfect Manifesto is about having the agencies give you strategic direction and high-level concepts, asking for concepts to be worked up, going to second or even third stages and rounds of revision is the final one as well. Really. Let's limit what agencies need to do to help them to limit the cost and the investment and resources they need to put into it. And final one, ethical pitching. If I could pitch to clients on here, you know, be fair to your agencies, give them the respect they deserve. Give them the feedback, treat agencies well, whether you're going to work with them or not. Don't ask them to do three-stage pitching where work's involved and they're just throwing good money after bad because the winner's already pretty clear. So that's my 10 points.
I think there's so much both agencies and clients can learn from there. And this is not just agency people saying we want better pitches. You know, it's actually a mutually beneficial thing.
Yeah.
You will get a better response and you will get a more robust proposal from an agency. If you follow these steps, you will get a better partner at the end of it.
Yeah.
Equally, the agency will be able to spend more time focusing on the actual work that they're doing for clients and do better work if we could all go through this sort of process.
You've just summarised it really well there, Ben. I think, you know, following the principles there of that manifesto, it's going to get the clients better results as well. And you're absolutely right. You know, the agency is prepared to jump through hoops, pitch for anything, throw a credible amount of money at these pitches. They're not the agencies in demand, are they, at the end of the day? They're agencies that are desperate for work.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, that it's not in the client's interest to pursue that. It's in the client's interest to get the best people to pitch, but to find three or four of the most appropriate agencies, give them all the best chance of getting their best work across and making a choice from there.
So you have convinced me with your, what I'm going to describe as an ironic pitch to end pitching. Your pitch to end pitching, I agree with it, if we define it as the pitch and pray. So we're going to put pitch and pray pitching into Marketing Room 101. We're going to advocate for the Pitch Perfect Manifesto. Let's think about this process so that we can get a mutually better outcome for both clients and agencies. So that's done. That's bad.
I'm delighted, by the way. I'd cheer if I thought it would. The sound wouldn't carry anywhere because it's so noisy.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So that's done. Now, while you're down here, do you want to take anything back and distribute to the whole industry, all of your clients and all of their clients' clients?
Well, I would, of course. And again, I'm going to be in danger of picking an obvious one, but I'd like to pull out of Marketing Room 101 the contact report.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So many,
not the sexiest nomination.
But
as a former account handler, you have my ear.
It's not the most, but it really important, I think. And contact report, there'll be many people listening to this won't even understand what that is because they're probably half my age. But years ago, when I was an account handler and you were in your early stage of being an account handler, account handlers after meetings with clients did contact reports, and there were meeting minutes, there were action lists, there were a record of what was agreed, and then they were typed out. And that practice has disappeared. And I understand that because I'm not a dinosaur, and we're far too busy now. Things move far quicker than they ever did. We're far too busy as agencies. Clients are far too busy. But we often do have meetings and finish the meeting without a clear reference as to what was actually agreed. Yeah. What's the next steps? But we all leave meetings with notes and things, hopefully. But have we interpreted things in exactly the same way? Are we clear on who's accountable or who's responsible for the next action? And the contact report used to do that. And we have, you know, of course, AI note-taking apps. There's millions of them now for our online meetings, which are incredibly good, of course, at what they do, because they make an exact replica of the conversation. But again, do we refer back to them? Did they summarise the actions in a clear way? And also, generally, people use their own. It's not a unified, single source of truth. So I'm hoping that we can retrieve a modern version of the contact report. I think it's important as a record, but I think it's important as a mindset as well, because I think we do so many meetings these days, and not all meetings are about actions. There are more fluid brainstorm meetings, etc. But most of the meetings, important meetings, we're there to create actions, we're there to make decisions, and I think the mindset and the discipline of recording those has been lost. So that's my pitch for that.
I've spent most of my career so far in client services. And I think the contact report feels like an example of a wider issue. I think that we see a trend amongst a number of agencies away from believing in the value of client service. And I often find myself describing to people or trying to really advocate for the power of client service. It should be the heartbeat of the agency. It should be the sort of hub in the middle. And it's these conversations that we have about principals all the time is let's make sure that we have our other teams, our specialists, but we're freeing them of the need to deal with clients, the creative people, strategic people. Those people are really specialists in what they do. If you then say to those people, we're all going to start dealing with clients so we can reduce our prices because it's so competitive out there, that's completely overlooking what value a client services person can bring to an account. Arguably, it is one of the most important, potentially the most important role in an agency. They're growing the clients. They're making sure that client has been listened to. And I think it goes down to little things like a contact report.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as we say, we're both ex-account handlers and we are biased, but I think I understand that we need to run lean operations. Of course we do, but I still believe in the value of an account handling function. Communication, relationship building, facilitating is a valuable thing. And for the agency, it is about developing the business, of course, as well. But the benefits to the client in terms of good communication that the account handler can bring, one cornerstone of that used to be the contact report or a list of actions. Clients are busy. I mean, we often in agencies get frustrated with clients, but having been, you know, exposed to many of them over the years, I know how difficult their role is. They're in back-to-back meetings talking about a variety of subjects, not just about what their core function is. Days fly by, you know, they're extremely stressful and high-pressure jobs. But that having that communication, the account manager, if they, after every meeting, summarise just in a very succinct way what the actions were as a record, then I'm sure that would be valuable to the client.
100%. It goes back to what you were saying earlier, where you said, as much as it's a tangible thing, it's a mindset, both internally that says, we've defined our actions, we know what we're doing. Yep. But the message that sends to a client, I mean, I'd be interested to hear from any clients about whether that is important to you or not. But the way I've always seen it is being on the front foot in that respect, sending a contact report, listening to a client when they said, I'm going to come back to you on this date, it shows that you've listened and just sends that message that says, don't worry, we've got this,
yeah. And also gives the client the opportunity to glance at something, hopefully quite succinct, and say, yeah, that's it, that was my, oh, actually, no, they've missed a bit, you know. Yeah. I also asked for or wanted them to do X, and nobody seems to have caught that, or maybe I didn't communicate that clearly enough, so I'll make sure that that's added onto the list so that next time we meet, we've covered off everything I needed.
Okay, that feels like a perfect place, don't it? It feels like we've covered a lot of ground there, and I think we've solved a lot of problems, or I'm hoping we have. To sort of summarise this, I'm going to accept in Marketing Room 101 the pitch and pray process.
Yes.
That is now in here, and that will be in here forever.
Yeah, good.
You're going to take contact reports, but also I'm going to describe it as good, attentive client service.
Yes.
Nice. And you're going to take that back and distribute it to every agency.
Let's spread the word.
How do you feel?
I think that's a result. I think our work here is done.
I think so. Gareth, how can people get hold of you if they want to contact you, if they want to speak to you about Cactus?
Yes, I'm on LinkedIn, of course, as Gareth Healy, H-E-A-L-E-Y. That's the best place there. Link in, follow, message me. It'd be great to speak to anybody about this subject or anything to do with agencies, really.
And if not, I can probably track you down at a Man City game.
They certainly can. Yeah, yeah, definitely. But don't let that put anybody off if they support an opposing team. Beyond Saturday and Sunday afternoons, it's all good.
I think you've followed Man City since before they were cool.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Everybody says that, but I've got the grey hair or the no hair to prove that probably is feasible.
Okay, Gareth, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben.
So that was my conversation in Marketing Room 101 with Gareth Healy. If you enjoyed it, could you please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts? It's apparently really important for helping more people discover this show. So think of it this way. Every one person introduced to this podcast could mean one fewer person listening to dodgy health advice from Stephen Bartlett. And of course, if you've really enjoyed it, please share it with loved ones and strangers on your preferred social medium. This podcast is not sponsored by Principles Agency. If it was, it probably wouldn't sound like it was being produced on Windows 98, but as it's where I work and they give me and everybody else a free day off every week, which I spend doing this, I feel obliged to give it a plug. At Principles, we're obsessed with the word unforgettable, meaning we help everyday brands come to mind quicker and stay there longer. We do this using a set of principles the team and I developed. This means making brands distinctive, entertaining, visible, and consistent. If you'd like to chat about how we can help you or learn more about the principles of unforgettable brands, just pop me, Ben Norman, or Principles Agency a message on LinkedIn, or head to principlesagency.co.uk.